Hello, everybody. Welcome back to This Weird House. I am Nick Boddick, and today I'm here with a very special guest, truly one of my favorite authors, period, ever. I'm here with Mr. Laird Barron. How are you today, Laird?
Great, Nick. Thanks for having me on.
Absolutely. So I've been a fan of yours for a few years now. I came across the Imago sequence.
You can say it either way.
And that was actually the title story. It was the first story I read, and from there I just kind of went backwards and forwards from there and just kind of devoured everything you had. And I just kind of wanted to talk to you about your, I guess, just because you've built this whole, the whole old leech mythos is just fascinating to me, because there seems to be a lot that connects to it, but I still really have no idea what it all is, which I assume is by design. A couple nights ago I actually finished The Croning for the first time. I'm not sure why it took me so long to read it. I am more of a short story guy, that's probably why. But I kind of wanted to talk to you. I know we're talking about a 11-12 year old book at this point, but I loved it so much, and I do this podcast for me, so I just wanted to talk to you a bit about it.
Sure.
So where in the writing of all the your great many short stories did The Croning come about, and how did the novel start, and what turned it from, did you go into it expecting to write a novel?
Right. The Croning, which that came out in 2012, I believe. Like spring 2012. So yeah, it's been almost exactly 12 years now, which is an eon in publishing. And, I kind of look at it as the culmination of the first phase of my writing career, my publishing career. I've certainly written cosmic horror since then, and I will continue to do so. And I've written stories that are related to that novel and the stories that led up to the novel, but it is interesting because it really does mark sort of an ending or a transitionary phase of my writing life. And I worked on that novel. People talk about writers talk about working on novels for like a decade, but I probably did work on that for 7 or 8 years before I actually wrote it. But it wasn't like it was every day. It wasn't, I didn't just sit down and grind away at it. It was more, I wrote a few chapters and then set it aside and wrote a bunch of short stories, then come back and delete everything or rewrite everything I had written. And finally, what happened is I had published a couple collections with Nightshade, and they really wanted a novel. And I knew from the beginning, like in 2007, 2008, they wanted a novel. So about 2008, I really seriously started thinking about it. I took out my notes and said, okay. But one thing led to another, and it's still sort of languished on the, I don't know, not quite the back burner, but a side burner, low heat. And I didn't really get serious about writing it until late 2010. And then I wrote it over about a 10 month period. I wrote a lot of it in Montana. Actually, I was staying in a cabin on my brother's property, and very remote. And I wrote most of it. I started it in Washington State. I wrote probably three quarters of it in Montana in that cabin, and then I finished it off that same year when I moved over. I'm living in the Hudson Valley now, near the Catskills, and I was renting a room from the Langens, John Langen, famous horror writer, really dear friend of mine. He and his family, rented me a room, and I stayed with them for quite a while. And I finished the novel there, and then began the next phase of my writing.
Okay, that's awesome. I'm also picturing like a reality show of just horror, cosmic horror authors living together.
It was great. It was actually, I tell you, the time I stayed, because I had gotten divorced, and it was just a really rough personal time for everybody. And I ended up just packing up my truck, pretty much all I had in the world, my dog and my truck and a couple bags of clothes, and that was about it. and I stayed in Montana. And I did the thing, you know, just where you, you know, your kind of life, your personal life is shattered and you just sort of hunker down. And I hunkered down, and my brother, you know, and his family were really kind. And I just, it was a great, you know, I got to hang out with my nephews and nieces and you know, some people that I didn't get to see very often. And so I hung out with them for a few months, wrote the novel, wrote some other short stories in this really scenic, I mean, it's like something out of a, it'd be like something out of a Time Life movie. It was really, I just get up, there'd be caribou in the yard, and I'd go back and make a cup of coffee and work. And I was working like, you know, 18 hours a day at that point. Just that's what grief will do to you. And then I had this epic trip with my dog over here to the East Coast. And then, yeah, 3 years, you know, living with the Langens. And I wrote, finished the Croning, did all the editing work on the Croning, then wrote a couple more collections while I was there in my first crime novel. So it was that I could probably write a book about the conversations I had with John out walking the dogs in his neighborhood and just doing the various, you know, watching his son grow up. And his wife has had a horse, and we would go down to it was off the property. It was a few miles away, but we would drive down there 3 or 4 times a week and take care of her horse and a bunch of other horses. It was a big farm. So it was a really, that about a 3 year stretch there, Montana, and when I first moved to New York State and I was trying to figure, you know, reestablish my life, I pretty much just lived in a room and, you know, or in a cabin and wrote. 90% of my day would just be writing or taking care of animals or something. And it was a pretty cleansing experience, as they would say.
Yeah, I was going to say, for even though it was at a time of like turmoil, that does sound incredibly like gratifying and relaxing. That sounds so nice. I think we talked last time we talked, I mentioned my ultimate goal, like in my dream, is a cabin in, or not a cabin, but like a house in the middle of nowhere, Wyoming. And that's exactly what I want to do. I just want to be there with my wife, my cats, and just write all the time. That is my ideal life. So that's awesome that you got to do that.
I did. And like when I was growing up, we lived in the woods for, yeah, I wasn't born out in the woods. I mean, first few years of my life, we lived kind of a suburban lifestyle. But when I was about 9, we moved into like a one room cabin and lived there for many years, you know, all through my adolescence and through most of my teens, into my late teens. And I wrote by candlelight. I wrote by propane lantern or kerosene lamp, and I didn't, you know, didn't enjoy that. Then, you know, for many years I lived in Washington State in my 20, you know, late 20s to late 30s, pretty much through my 30s, where a lot of my early, you know, the entirety of my early career, my first couple collections, all that. And you couldn't ask for more white bread suburbia, you know, a nice little, you know, 10 minutes from the mall and, you know, trees outside, but you're not in the woods or anything. And it was electricity and everything was great. And then, you know, living in a normal house, picket fence, the whole thing. And then a few years living in a cabin again, and then kind of like in a boarding situation. And now I'm back to living in a house. But so I've had this spectrum of experience of writing novels and, you know, books in general in these different settings. I mean, when I lived in Seattle many years ago, I wrote a whole novel in a coffee shop. So I've kind of done most of it. The only thing I haven't done is like trying to write from the depths of a prison cell with a candle. You know, that's about it. So we'll maybe avoid that one.
Yeah, that's I unfortunately in a past life of mine, I was much younger, I did spend a little bit of time in jail, and there is copious amounts of time. That's all you have when you're inside. So like I see why people will write novels while they are doing extended sentences. Like it's
right. I was thinking more along the lines of, you know, like Desaad writing on
right.
his, you know what I mean? Like you're somewhere where there's like dripping cave wall and you're manacled to it. And you get to write on the flesh of your foot, you know, once a day. That's about the only thing I haven't experienced that. I think I'll just go ahead and imagine it. But
I would say,
it was I've seen both sides. I've seen how both sides, both halves live, so to speak. And it's been quite a journey.
And speaking of that, actually, you raced the Iditarod. I think that's how you would say that. And so I would love to just hear kind of your, I guess, your take on all of that. That's just fascinating to me. I've never, I'm very unfamiliar with all that, but it sounds like one of the most hardcore things a human being can do.
It was just the lifestyle in general was, it's like anything else. If you have money, everything's a lot easier. And we didn't have money. We were, I would say, pretty close to utter poverty for most of the time that I was involved in it. And it's been about 30, next year will be 30 years since the last time I, worked with sled dogs, really, for any, I did a little bit in Montana a few years ago when I was there, but not, it was just casual. But yeah, it's been about 30 years since I had sled dogs. And it's something that never, the experiences that I had, though, racing the Iditarod, training, just the entire lifestyle, living in the woods, just with me and the Huskies a lot of the time. It's something that never le that never is too far. Whenever I sleep, whenever I start do drowsing, I'm back on the Yukon. I remember one time I woke up on the Yukon River. I was 21. I just turned 21, and I was on the Yukon River, March 10th or 12th, somewhere in there. The first couple of weeks of March back in 1991, and I was exhausted about a week, 10 days into the race. And I woke up and I was staring up at the sky, and there was like a couple, there was clouds, but there was a couple stars peeking through. And it took me a few moments to remember where I was because I was so exhausted. I just had forgotten where I was. And like, oh yeah, you're on the Yukon, you're on the Yukon River. And I woke up, I took care of the dogs, and we went trudging along. It was about 3 in the morning. I've never forgotten that though. Every now and then I wake up and I'm there again, just for a moment between waking and sleeping. I'm back on the Yukon, or I'm on the Bering ice. I'm in a blizzard. Just being, I could just hear the wind blowing, or it's a cold night on the river, and the only thing I can hear are the dogs breathing in unison as they're trotting along in front of me. I can hear the sled track, rails crunching in the runners crunching in the snow. It never, it's 30 years ago, 30 something years ago in that case, and that it's never farther away than you and I talking right now.
How long is the Iditarod? Like, is it a
About
point A to point B, or is it like a circle?
no, it's a point A to point B. It's about 1,100 between it's between 11 and 1,200 miles.
Okay.
So it's a good distance,
Man.
and it's a there are checkpoints along the way, but it basically starts traditionally it starts in Anchorage, Alaska. Because of snow conditions, they usually have to move it around, but it travels out, north to Nome, and across the, several mountain ranges, goes up the Yukon River or down. There's a couple different routes they take. There's a southern and northern route they switch, but
Okay.
the point is, one year you go up the Yukon River, the next year you go down the Yukon River, but you always end up on the coast, up in Alaska, the Bering Sea, the Bering Coast, and you go up to Nome.
Okay. That's I don't even like driving my car to Walgreens. So that's admirable, man. That's just I can't even imagine doing something like that. That sounds so cool. Like, it
Yeah,
runs very
I don't miss the Iditarod. I don't miss racing. I do miss because there's two phases. It's really similar to writing in the sense that there's writing, the act of creation. You get up, you turn on the you light a candle and you write. And then there's publishing. And publishing can
Yes.
be satisfying if you're successful, you accomplish something, but it's a different sport, so to speak. And is a lot of
Yeah.
times it can be punishing. And there's a lot of stakes involved, a lot of heartbreak involved. And that's how I segregate my experiences with sled dogs and that whole lifestyle. There's the one aspect, which is you get up every day, put your long johns on, stagger out there and hook up the team and go train, because you have to train for pretty much every day. rain or shine, and you travel with the dogs and you get them, you know, just like a marathon runner or a Tour de France cyclist would train. You train every day and you build up to this, and then you go do your event once a year. And I enjoy the lifestyle, the training, the traveling with the dogs infinitely more than I don't look back on the racing aspect with nearly as much fondness.
Yeah. Okay, for sure. I can see that.
I enjoy writing more than I enjoy publishing, which is another example.
For sure. I was going to say, it's an interesting comparison to make. Like, I don't think I ever would have thought about it like that, but it makes sense because you can write all the live long day, but once publishing comes around, it's almost out of your hands, it seems like.
Yeah, you're basically the old man in the sea. You might be a great fisherman and you can prepare yourself as best you can, you know, as best you are able. But once that giant fish grabs hold, all you can do is hold on and just hope that your preparations will allow you to survive this event. You don't necessarily have much say though beyond that. And I think it's pertinent to a conversation like this, cause you know, we're talking about writing, is just that, I've always said that, right, it's important to enjoy writing as an act if you want to survive as a publishing. Because I feel like publishing for most of us is something that you survive. I think there's a small group, and it was the same thing in racing dogs. I'm sure it's the same thing in almost any competitive sport. You look at a small, you know, small dollar franchises. You know, the Detroit Lions just now playing, you know, for the first time, and they had a chance for the first time in 60 years to go to the Super Bowl. The bottom line is, for most of us, we're have nots, and to some degree. And so, you know, if you're not that tiny minority that, you know, things fall right for them, it's a tough go. And therefore, I feel it's critical for me, for example, that I love to write. Because that diminishes to some degree the ups and downs of the publishing experience. You know, the problem that I have with it, just that when you get to a certain point and you rely upon income from, whether it's as my dad did racing sled dogs, he relied upon that income. And I rely upon the income of selling stories and books. But so that creates sort of a complicating factor. However, if we didn't love the intrinsic act of training the dogs and being with those animals, or with the act of writing, creating art, then it would be a very thankless endeavor.
Right. Cause yeah, you can get, you know, 100 rejections, but if you enjoyed and found some enjoyment or passion or, you know, what have you in the act of writing, then it's not a total loss. Yeah.
Right. And I constantly, you know, everybody always asks for advice. What advice do you have? And the biggest advice that I could give to people is just don't conflate. And I say this to people who have been publishing for years. It's easy. It's something that's easy to forget. I remind myself constantly, don't conflate the act of creating art with the commercial aspect of art. They may be related, you know, inextricably linked, but there's a big difference between, you know, being angry at publishing and how your career may or may not be going, and conflating that with, well, I hate writing. You know, maybe you do hate writing, but generally when somebody says they're angry or dispirited about writing, what they really are saying is they're dispirited that their writing is not being, you know, it's not succeeding at, you know, they're not succeeding in the publishing world in the way that they had hoped. And I think that's an important distinction, because, you know, if you are upset with writing, then that's something you could, maybe writing isn't for you. And there's something, you know, you're beating your head against a wall if you really are just frustrated with the art of writing. Like you always have writer's block, or you just, after all these years, you just cannot find the right words. But I think it'd be a tragedy though to confuse that with, my books aren't selling, therefore I hate writing. No, you hate the fact your books aren't selling. And I think that's totally rational to be upset about that. Yeah. But if you don't recognize it, it becomes this issue where writing takes the act of creating the art is what you become cynical about, and that's not what you should be cynical about.
Yeah, for sure. That is very solid advice. You have given me that advice before, personally. So I can say it is, in fact, good advice, tried and true. I got way off base there. I'm asking you about sled dog racing and stuff. So for The Croning, as I was reading it, I kind of picked out my own things. I'd be like, oh, this reminds me of this. This reminds me of that. Did you have any like concrete influences that you were going for when you were writing The Croning, or like things you were like, I love the style of this movie, or I love the style of this book, or, you know, the way the story unfolded here, I'm going to try to go for a similar thing with my own novel.
There was, you know, my cosmic horror is rooted in very much in, you know, Lovecraftian, especially my early stuff, my first, you know, 10 years, 12 years with The Croning, very much rooted in Machen, Blackwood, Lovecraft, Clark, you know, very overtly. And I wasn't really going for any particular style, although I wanted to fuse the more adventurous or pulpy aspects of a horror, cosmic horror novel with Rosemary's Baby or, you know, something quieter. And it would have been, actually the book would have been a lot quite different if I hadn't talked to Jeff Ford while I was writing it. And he had no idea what I was writing. His only advice to me, to this day, I carry this, he goes, go fucking crazy. He goes, your instinct is going to be conservative. You know, he goes, just do what you do. Do whatever you want to do. Do whatever you do in your short stories. He goes, do you ever worry about whether a short story is too wild? And I said, no. He goes, right. Don't write the novel with an eye toward, oh, I can't get away with that in a novel. He said, just do whatever you want. He goes, and then, you know, if they like it, they like it. If they don't, they don't. And so that was, my approach was tempered by that, by that advice. I'm not somebody that really seeks a lot of advice about writing. You know, I don't belong to a reading group or crit group or anything. Sometimes I'll hash things over just in conversation with some of my colleagues, but like I don't have a first reader. My first reader is going to be the editor. And then, you know, then we go from there, but I certainly listen to what other writers have and artists in general have to say about their craft. And that really struck with me. I mean, Ford is one of the greats. Not only is he a great writer, but he's also a great thinker. And as is John Langan, my good friend. And so, yeah, that was the guiding light for me, was just not to make it tame, just to do as I pleased. So I kind of end up fusing the slow burn with some pretty sort of radical elements, I would say.
Yeah, some bombastic, just,
yeah.
And it always seems to come out of nowhere, so it's well placed.
There's an overture, so yeah.
Yeah, the Great Dark was easily my favorite aspect of the whole book. I mean, I don't want to spoil it too much. I mean, I know it's a 12-year-old book, but I guess spoilers for The Croning, moderately. I just wanted to say that, like, The Great Dark was such, like, a, I don't know, it seems like the perfect encapsulation of, like, what do they say? Like, no monster is scarier than the one in your imagination or whatever.
Right.
And, like, The Great Dark was such a great a representation of that. Like, because you have Don walking through this area, this Great Dark, and you give these little tiny hints of what might be out there, what might be right next to his face, what might be 10 miles away. And that was such a, not many things give me like a visceral reaction when I'm reading. Like, things creep me out a little bit, but that was one part that really, that's probably stuck with me more than anything else in the book. And I love the way you did that. It was amazing.
Well, I appreciate it. I actually think that some of that descriptive or atmospheric stuff probably, you know, because nothing comes from a vacuum. So obviously everything is a distillation of things I've read, done, heard. And I do credit some of that, sort of the idea of going through the darkness, you know, with traveling with the dogs across gulfs. I mean, there are times when you're out there in Alaska, like I said, middle of the night, you're on the Yukon River, you feel insignificant. I fished in the Bering Sea. You're out there on a tender. But if you take a moment, you're just insignificant. One time I was running with the dogs across a ridgeline in interior of Alaska, and it was these old mountains all around, probably about the size of the Catskills, maybe a little smaller. No trees, though, just a few bushes here and there, and they were just rounded. They'd been worn down by the eons. And it wasn't a clear day. It was kind of a cloudy day. There was a little bit of snow coming down, but I still had great visibility for miles, and it was the same in all directions. It was like looking in a mirror. There was no really, you couldn't really differentiate the horizon or anything else. And I just thought how tiny we were. There was a huge herd of caribou, probably 300-400 animals at one point crossed in front of us. We were heading like north, south. They were going east, west. And they were all just tiny. We were just these tiny specks. And I haven't written about that kind of stuff, in my stories or novels, but it always has informed my thinking when I describe other aspects of, say, cosmic horror or just man's insignificance in the larger scheme.
Yeah, for sure. That's crazy. I can totally see the connection there. That's really interesting.
I mean, I think anybody who's spent any time on the ocean, sea, or out in the desert can tell you just how tiny we are. I think anybody can tell you that.
Yeah, I have. I never have, but for some reason, when I'm writing, oftentimes in my stories, characters will end up in places that like real remote, middle of nowhere, kind of. A lot of it has been the desert. I've never been to the desert. I don't know why that happens. It's my subconscious coming out and being like, you should probably go here, I guess. So I wanted to talk to you a little bit about Old Leech, itself, but also I know that there is no, you've never like given like an accounting of this is what Old Leech is, but I kind of more about the influences in your head when sure. you came up with the ideas, or when you came up with the concept of Old Leech. Like, did you have any like entities in your mind, fictional entities in your mind? Did you have any like scary movie monsters that inform the image that you have of this, of Old Leech?
Yeah. You know, Old Leech is just my spin on the old, he would fit right into the Lovecraftian circle of, godlike monstrosities that kind of live just beyond our veil, without necessarily being one of those. But, early on in my career, that's where a lot of the stuff came from, was not just, directly from Lovecraft, but from all of the people who have come along since. I mean, including one of my favorites, science fiction writer Roger Zelazny, who wrote occasionally, or Fritz Leiber. And so I just said from the start, oh, okay, this is great. I mean, the Children of Old Leech, Clive Barker's another huge influence. A lot of times it's not even conscious, because as a writer, I mean, you understand this, you're constantly trying to make sure that you're doing something different. But it's when you consciously go, oh no, this is too close to something else, you'll try to. But unfortunately or fortunately, we are a product of what we eat, what we see. And it's not until you've written a lot. I was like 10 or 12 years into my career, and so I had a body of work over years that I could look back and go, oh, wow, Life Burial sure comes up a lot. Wow, Poe, I guess Poe was a lot more influential than I thought, right? I mean, but I didn't see that until I stepped back from the mosaic and went, oh, I can see all, that 3D image trick that they do at the mall, Now all of a sudden, if you look at it long enough, you can start seeing what really is there. So, in retrospect, I can look and, at the time I wasn't really plotting out, like I wasn't thinking about influence as much. I kind of had an idea what I wanted to do and how I wanted to diverge from my influences, but I had a lot of plans, but that I wasn't that worried about where it was all coming from. But certainly, you know, in retrospect, I'm like, oh, well, Clive Barker and with his Cenobites and the Lovecraft's Mego, you know, the fungi from Yggdrasil, are certainly components of the Children of Old Leech. And Old Leech itself, you know, Sith Agwa or Cthulhu or, right? There's a black guy that's similar. It's not the same as the Necronomicon, but see, that's the cool thing about the Lovecraftian mythos is that there was a ton of creepy books, tomes, and treatises. Mm-hmm. So this just fit that. So in other words, I'm working with kind of a tradition. The same way when I wrote my crime novels, I didn't really try to reinvent the wheel with the crime novels. I just said, all right, there are multiple types of crime novel or thriller, what have you. There's the, you know, the Irish cop, ex-cop. There's the dainty, you know, English, you know, or French, or, you know, never get his hands mussy, you know, kind of philosopher. There's the narcoleptic detective as a la Tremblay. There's the manic depressives. There's all this. I said, all right, I'll do a combination of Travis McGee and Spencer and, you know, some of the thug-like detectives. Yeah. But he won't be an Irish. You know, he'll be, you know, mixed race, and we'll infuse it with the supernatural. But the point is that that's kind of how I approach all of it. It's like, all right, I'm working within. This is the clay I have to work with. What I'm going to do that's different is interpret it. Like I'm going to interpret it a different way. So Old Leech specifically, the genesis there was actually thanks to John Langan. Back in the early aughts, he wrote a story called On Skua Island. It's just one, it's this tiny little I won't say throwaway, but it's a really just subtle description. They're looking at, the archaeologists are looking at some carvings, and there's one of like, it looks like a worm, and the worm's kind of coiling in on itself. And I said to him, I said, are you going to do anything else with that? And he said, I don't think so. It's just, it really had nothing to do with anything. And I said, because I'd like to do something with that. And part of the reason I wanted to do something with it at the time is because I really love the Lovecraft Circle tradition of writers calling out to each other in their works. Mm-hmm. So subtle, not just Tuckerizations, but like, no, characters that might reappear, like a minor character in one story is a main character in another author's tale, that kind of thing. Yeah. And just, you know, just subtle. So like if you weren't privy to the group's interrelationships, you know, the writer groups, it wouldn't matter. But if you did know, you'd be like, aha, that's pretty cool. Yeah. Right. And so that's all that was. And it just kind of, for better or for worse, it just sort of took off. So yeah, I got that from him. I don't think he had a name. It was just a worm. And I thought to myself, I said, a worm. Yeah. Lovecraft does worms though. There's the worm that walks, there's, you know, and the Ouroboros is interesting. I want to use it. I said, oh, what's scarier than a, you know, for me, what's scarier than a worm? I'm like, a leech. I had a bad experience with them when I was a kid, like a very young child. So I said, a leech. Leeches are just awful. So that's where that came from. And it just, and then of course there's the Black Guide, which is associated with it. And the Black Guide was, I was sitting there talking to John and Paul Tremblay. It's back in 2007. It was right before I started writing all the old leech stuff. And John was telling me that he and his wife years ago had been traveling and they found like a guidebook stuffed in they were like on a bus or something. I probably mangling this, but essentially they found it just like, it was just this weird little, like an almanac, and it was a travel guide, and it was stuffed like on the bus. It was like in a between the cushions or something. And they just started reading it. It was like hand notes in it about places like hostels to go to and stuff like that. And I said, what if people just kept finding those? You know, and so the three of us started talking about it, going, yeah, what if like there's no publisher, but they just keep versions of it, just keep appearing in different places. And John's like, yeah. And what if there's like another version of it that's like a website? And Paul's like, yeah. What if there's actually, you know, what if it's something else? And you find out that it maybe goes back to carvings, or, you know, maybe people were using chiseling it, some version of this back in the Homer days. So we each talked about using that in our stories, the, you know, different versions of the Black Guide. And so that's where, so that all kind of, a lot of that stuff happened during a conversation at ReaderCon back in 2007. We were drunk and like we were out of our minds drunk, and we were just sitting around just bullshitting. And, you know, each of them has done something with it. I kind of just ran with it and kept build, you know, it kind of became a huge part of that, of my cosmic horror identity. But each one of them is also, they've done, you know, if you piece through their work, you're going to find little bits of Old Leech and the Black Guide and both of their bibliographies.
Yeah. Oh, man. To be a fly on the wall during that conversation must have been fascinating. I was going to ask about the Black Guide in particular, but you just answered my question, actually. Mysterium Tremendum is one of my favorite short stories of yours.
Thank you.
What was I going to say? I just had something. I want to talk a little bit. I mean, you've talked about your horror influences, I'm sure on every podcast you've ever gone on. I just want to talk to you a little about your crime novel.
Sure.
The Isaiah Coleridge series and all that, just kind of did you read a lot of like crime literature when you were younger, or like as you were growing as a writer, like what made you want to go from horror to that? Or if it's the other way, what made you go from crime to horror?
Right. Here's the deal. I've read far more, I would say overall throughout my life, far more crime, thriller, mystery than I have horror. I don't get me wrong. I've written and read plenty of horror, and I love it. But westerns, fantasy, crime, mystery, thriller probably outweigh by a considerable margin my horror diet. And became a horror writer because that's just sort of just happened, but I just discovered that I was good at it. I would tell stories to my family and then sometimes my friends, and it would, you know, they were always entertained. But whenever I told a horror story, I found that I had a special reaction. I really enjoyed that, because when I sold my first couple horror stories back in 2000, 2001, I was still on the side writing a lot of science fiction, actually, and fantasy, with very much noir elements. There weren't really many horror elements. And, but I found that when I wrote horror, it was just, or pure crime, it just clicked more easily for me. So that's why, there's a couple things that happened. One, so back in those days, between 2000 and 2010, I pretty much wrote two or three stories a year at the max. I had a day job, exhausted mentally and physically all the time for that decade. And so I wrote every day, but it would take me 6 months to write a story a year, sometimes 9 to 10 months to write a story. You know, we're talking, you know, I maybe get 50 pages of fiction done a year type of thing. And so every time publishing was, you know, it's always precious, but you know, you're talking about it. So somebody's trying to establish a career, and the most I'm going to get is two or three stories a year. So this is going to take a while. And it did. It took at least 7 or 8 years of publishing before I kind of broke through. But I remember I got this advice once again, and I got this from Gordon Van Gelder, who had published my first three or four stories. And he said, "I refer to you as a horror author when I'm talking to other industry professionals. Does that bother you that I refer to you as a horror author? I'm telling people to check out your work and stuff." And I said, "No. No, it doesn't." And he goes, "Great." He goes, and then the advice came, and it was, "For now, I would, you know," and I'm just paraphrasing, but he said, "I suggest that you really establish your identity. If this is what you like to do and this is what you want to do, establish yourself as a horror author until you get at least a book or two out there and you establish yourself as a name." He goes, "And then," he goes, "you can do what other writers, Barker, King, all of them have done, Kuntz. Then you can write your thrillers. Then you can do your historical romance if that was what floats your boat. But you need to become, you know, known Laird Barron author. And this is the kind of experience I'm going to get from him." And And so that's what I did. I very much stuck to it. And I stuck to that for at least the first, actually, 16 years of my career. It was pretty much all horror. And but I infused it with, because I love crime, mystery, that kind of thing. I infused, you'll notice that a lot of my stories could easily just be a crime story that has some horror horrific elements. So I have been writing kind of in two or three genres this whole, that whole time. It was just, if you put horror in something, that's what it's going to be. That's how it's going to be labeled. It's going to be labeled a, any horror aspect is going to automatically make it a horror story. Mm-hmm. So what happened is, around 2013 or so, there was the big bankruptcy deal with, we don't need to go into that, but basically my publisher went under, and there was a lot of question as to whether many of us with books with them would lose our rights to our books. It was a pretty terrifying time. And I had a new agent, and my agent was crime and thriller. And so I said, look, I want to write a crime novel. And she's, oh God, yeah, good. Something that might make some money. So that's what happened. I started writing. I wrote that first crime novel. Part of it was also a personal challenge. The Blood Standard, the first Isaiah Coleridge novel, has, I would say, I won't say zero supernatural elements, but 1%. He gets weird feelings about things, or he sees patterns, but that's all. And then the books 2 and 3, especially as I realized that, the series was not going to be continued with them, I said, fuck it. And this, by the midway through the second one, I started injecting more, not quite supernatural elements, but certainly supernatural adjacent. And then by the third mm-hmm. book, you could look at it either way. If you're a supernatural horror fan, you love it. If you just like straight crime fiction, you can kind of stomach it. Like, maybe it's not the supernatural. I don't know. I mean, you see that going on with the season 4 of True Detective. Like, mm-hmm. the horror fans are all like, you happy? And the crime fans are like, I don't know. I don't know about this. So mm-hmm. That's kind of what happened. But there have been some astute observations from critics who followed my entire career going, he always wrote crime. He always wrote crime. He always wrote thrillers. He always wrote noir. It's just that there would be, some kind of supernatural or paranormal element, and that would obfuscate what the story, what a lot of the story really was, the framework of the story.
Yeah. So just, I have two questions. Just kind of, you have written, it's like your work is tailored specifically to my interests, and I thank you for that. That's very kind of you to write these things specifically with me in mind. The Procession of the Black Sloth is perhaps my favorite short story of all time. Wow. And I just was wondering, like, what sparked that idea? Was that in... Did that come in the middle of you starting to develop all this old leech stuff, and or was it just another cosmic horror story you just happened to write? And it just is what it is. It just, that story, for whatever reason, seems to me like to be like a pivotal moment in like the Laird Barron canon, so to speak. And I'm not exactly sure why. It just seems, that one seems to have so much more like behind it. It's hard to say what I mean.
So it's actually sort of complex, that the circumstances and the influences and the motivations behind that story. It's one of the few stories in the first three collections. Because I look at that, the first three collections, almost as one, like a novel in three parts or a mosaic. It always was intended.
And that's Imago Sequence, Beautiful Thing That Awaits Us All.
And Occultation, then the Beautiful
Occultation,
Thing.
Occultation, that's right, yes.
Right. Okay, and so I'll preface this just by saying that early on, with like after the first couple of stories, I decided to work within a, not necessarily like a continuity, but just that the stories would be loosely related in a kind of a cosmos. Might be alternate dimensions, but there's, and you could read one and not another, and you could jump in anywhere. But I wanted some kind of, at least on the peripheral, like a nagging sense that these were all sort of connected in some way. J- just for another layer. But the Procession of the Black Sloth was written right before the book came out. Like, so all the other ones had were over the course of a few years. That one, and they've been published and reprinted and all this, you know, in general. And there was like 8 of them. And so they'd all been published before, except for, I'm trying to think if there's one other one that wasn't published. But the point is that it was basically the big original story in that collection. And I wrote it. The book came out like in July. I probably wrote that a few months beforehand. I said, okay, I want to do an original story. But I wanted it to be like suitable, like to fit within the framework of that collection. I felt like all the stories needed to work together, but that it signaled something, that it signaled a shift. So you'll notice it wasn't set on the East or the West Coast. It wasn't, you know, there were like a lot of the other stories were pretty much just guys doing things, hard boiled square jaw dudes. This one, yeah, it had a male protagonist, but there were women in it. There was, you know, there was a different setting, you know, it was set in Hong Kong. Mm-hmm. And it wasn't a cosmic, I mean, you could say it's related to cosmic horror, but it's much more of a traditional Buddhist or Judeo-Christian, you know, like kind of real world spiritualism and mythology, mm-hmm. you know, the idea of hells. And that was all intentional. That was all, I said, okay, it needs to fit, but it also needs to signal I changed as a writer over. So that was, I wrote that in 2006. I've been publishing for about 6 years, especially at the beginning of your career. There's a lot of change that occurs over 6 years. There should be. So I was a different person by then than I had the guy that wrote Old Virginia or, you know, Shiva or whatever. The other component, so that was all intentional. The other component, was I was really, really, thanks to Lucius Shepard, the late, great Lucius Shepard, who was a great author, great critic, just a great community member, and always with the good advice for the younger writers, that sort of thing. But one of the things he did for me is that he was always informally reviewing Asian horror and drama. Mm. So I had been interested in independent and foreign film for several years before that. But early to mid aughts, I started really getting into the, you know, like the Japanese and Korean horror scene. And certainly not to the degree that he was, but I watched my share and I wanted to do a story that paid homage to Mika and Kurosawa, you know, like Pulse and Cure and things like that. And mm-hmm. some of the Japanese crime drama that I'd seen. So I should say Asian because it was like all different, you know, it was all different area regions, but that's where, so the story in some ways has, it's kind of a satire. It's kind of a parody. I also told it in the way that the Asian community likes to tell stories. It's not quite as cut and dried as a Hollywood story. They'll just inject slapstick comedy in the middle of a dead pitch black drama. I've seen so many horror movies that take these. It's A, B, C, D. Okay. Now we're doing quantum physics. Like where do we, how are we over here? And then all of a sudden back on the trail again. And so so there's a couple things going there. The story embodies kind of imagery from all that. And as some people have picked out, pretty much every character, there's like one or two exceptions. Pretty much every character in the story is named for a horror, dark thriller writer, actor, character.
I know I picked up a few of those when
every single person in there is, there's like, I had to go back. There was like two people that I couldn't, and I kind of just let it be. I let them be just sort of floating around, but pretty much everybody else is someone who either lived or was written about or acted, you know, was a character in a movie or an actor or something like that.
Yeah.
And it was all because the idea was I wasn't even trying to really be cute or gimmicky. It was more, I tried to write a story and not, you know, cosplay Asian writing or film, mm-hmm. filmmaking, but no, there's a filter. Like one of the things that makes for me as a Westerner that makes, Asian drama, especially horror, so affecting is that there's this filter. Like for me, not being a native speaker or not being immersed in that culture, I don't know sometimes the cues that we take for granted, the idioms, things like that. So sometimes you don't know what you think is odd or is just simply odd to your experience. And so I tried to write the story that way. I tried to write the story, from my point of view. That's why I also had, a white male Westerner trying to, hang out in this multicultural society in Hong Kong.
Yeah.
That it was all intended to kind of create this sort of disjointed effect. And that is, I want to say, satire may not be the wrong word for that story. I think absurdism is more what I was going for, the absurdity of the whole thing.
That's super interesting. So we are kind of getting down to the end here. And I do want to say, if I could, I know I'm getting ahead of myself, but I would like to have you on eventually again. I have a million things I still want to talk to you about, but the story More Dark. I mean, I have to imagine you've been asked about this one a lot. I can't tell if reading it, there's a, oh geez, one of my cats just almost fell. Sorry. I can't tell if there's like a, I don't want to say like a bitterness, but like it just, where did More Dark come from? How about that?
Well, I'm not going to tell you everything about it because I think there'll come a day where I'll talk more, but I have spoken about it. And I know that people, I feel that people are owed an explanation, at least a basic explanation of it, because it's a rough story and there's multiple motivations. There's multiple reasons why I wrote it. It's not so simple as, oh, I had a great idea for a story and I wrote it. Like 90% of the time, I think it's with most of us, you have an idea, you write about it. It's not, there's nothing premeditated. You try to, you have an idea for a story and you write that story. And I would say most of the time, that's how I work. I go, oh, this would be a great first story. No, this was intentional. This story was a message story. It kind of encapsulated, I was going through a very terrible time. So it's very close to the bone. But as far as, it's been considered an attack on various people. And one of those things is, it's dishonest for me to say it's not, but I think there's way more nuance. It's a full-throated attack on certain people, but in other senses, there's just collateral damage or misinterpretation of it. Like, for example, it's not an attack on Ligotti whatsoever. I have huge disagreements with Ligotti's philosophy, but I don't have any problem with him, feeling how he feels, allegedly, how he allegedly feels. I don't have any problem with his writing. I think he's a great writer. I don't have a problem with people, being fans of him or adhering to his philosophy, but I object to the cult, what I perceive as kind of a cult-like behavior around him. I have, I've made no secret of this. I have mental health struggles. I have bipolar, which I'm very lucky to be here. And let's just put it that way. And, long before I had my recent my physical health problems, I've always struggled with depression. And living can be hard for any of us. But if you struggle with mental health, it can, become it becomes a mountainous sometimes, and not to climb, but it's like on your back. And so I have taken exception as someone who has similar issues to Ligotti, I believe, from just what's been described. I take exception to mental illness or depression being a superpower. I'm like, no, it's not a fucking superpower. It's not a fetish. And I feel like, not everyone, but I feel like people that I otherwise would respect have fetishized aspects of his perceived difficulties with mental health. Like, oh, I wish I had, I wish I could be bipolar so I could write like, no, you don't. And of course,
man,
I'll never have children. I don't want to bring children to this world. Part of the reason is I wouldn't bring a kid in the world and give them any chance that I would pass on something hereditary. But I have no problem. I'm not philosophically opposed to everybody else having kids. So I'm not an antinatalist, and I don't, you know, this or a pessimist, I guess, probably even more germane, the idea that, oh, it'd be better if we all just died. I don't buy into that either. Somebody who's almost died multiple times, and has actually been, I've laid in a hospital bed gurgling for breath. Sure, I didn't like it. Nobody wants to go out like that. Nobody wants to go out at all. But you know what? I really treasure all the things that I've done in my life. So I am in dire opposition to the philosophy, but more so with the sort of like, fetishizing it, but also just this whole ennobling of being mentally ill and struggling. And I don't, you know, I really, that actually, I'm getting angry right now. It really upset me. So it was more of that story is, unfortunately, it's really complicated, but one of the central conceits of that story is just fuck that. This whole kind of slavish devotion to a guru. I am very much opposed to gurus because there's Kool-Aid waiting for you somewhere down that, down that path. So it wasn't a slap at people who think that he's the greatest writer. It's not a pushback against him being one of probably the most important writers, you know, in the last 100 years. Not at all. It was simply a very dark and, you know, kind of satirical look at a cult of personality. But there was a couple other elements. And so the next element that people deserve a explanation for is were you picking on all these other writers? Oh, I might have been, you know, making snarky remarks about writers, but the main character, which is obviously me, takes it in the shorts just as much as anybody else, if not more so. And out of all the other writers that were mentioned, there was only one or two that, maybe two, that definitely, if they took it ill, good. You can't punch him in the nose. Fine. This is, you can go home and cry on your pillow about this
take
story.
What you can get.
And they did. See, this is the thing about writers. You could literally chain up a writer and beat him with a stick. They aren't going to like it. But if you tell them, you know, if you say something snarky about their sales numbers or their latest critical reviews, they will curl into the fetal position and bawl. Not all of them, but enough, right? I don't read my reviews as he wipes the tears. I don't read those. Yeah, well, that was intentional. And I don't think now is the time to go into who it was or why. But if you thought that I was, you know, sticking a knife in, I probably was, and you deserved it as far as I'm concerned. Listen, like I said, this time a year ago, I was on my deathbed, and I did, that's a good time to take stock. And I did, I had time to take stock. I was coherent. I didn't find God, and I didn't regret more dark as I was lying there, you know, maybe breathing my last. So I don't feel very apologetic at all about that.
Well, yeah, no, I respect that. And specifically, I think I've talked about it on a different podcast before, the fetishization of mental illness. I know it's not a word, but I've always referred to it as the romanticization of it. And like, it's like the TikTok trend of people ascribing a diagnosis to the entire range of basic human behaviors. Yeah. Like, oh, I get annoyed when people talk loud in public. That means I have ADHD and borderline personality disorder. Like, it's become like a badge of honor to have. Right. I also have bipolar disorder. I was diagnosed about 9 years ago. And I'm always just like, if you want it, you can have mine. Like, I will never understand. Like, I think it's like an attention seeking thing, probably. Because I cannot fathom why anyone would wake up and be like, being so depressed that I can't get out of bed is something that sounds wonderful to me today.
Like, well, I just want to make one thing clear. I'm not, I certainly don't, you know, however individuals feel about their you know, their health diagnoses. That's their business. And I, you know, my thing is, and I certainly, that's why I'm careful to say that I share commonalities with Ligotti, but I can't, you know, I don't know the range or the spectrum or the depth. I mean, two people can have bipolar disorder and have completely different reactions to it. Your characteristics will present themselves. All, you know, all I'm saying is just I personally, in this regard, without speaking to the without speaking to it in a broader sense, just specifically, I react poorly, have reacted very poorly to trying to turn it into a superpower and an explanation for, you know, how it's great. I'm like, I don't think you need to wallow in anything. I don't wallow in my situation. I don't, it's certainly not an excuse for any mistakes I make. It's just another thing. I'm missing an eye, you know, that's just, it's the way it is. But me missing an eye is not a superpower either. So, you know, I'm going to react to that. Rightly or wrongly, that was just my reaction, because, you know, it really struck home, and I'm not blaming Ligotti for that. You know, I don't know that I can't say that he's cultivated that. The bottom line is, once you get to a certain level of fame or infamy, people say what they want to about you, and they, you know, if they want to create a cult, they will. There's not much you can do about it. Yeah, so that's, you know, that's where that's coming from. And More Dark was extremely, you know, on top of the technical, there's a technical aspect to it too. Can you, you know, I think every writer at some point wants to write one of these, you know, stories that basically satirizes their life. And I think it's like a coming of age kind of thing. And I did it, and I'm, you know, I'm unrepentant.
Yeah, good. Stand behind it. I respect that. And also, I just want to be clear, I didn't want to misspeak before. One thing that I totally, if people, I respect how people feel. Like, I don't know how someone else is feeling at any given point, and all of their, whatever issues anyone is having are valid if that's what they're experiencing. What I don't like is, like you, I also don't like the, you know, making it a superpower. I loathe self-diagnosis. Like, that bothers me a lot. And where you get kind of worked up about the whole superpower, self-diagnosis, and people diagnosing each other, like friends being like, oh, well, I read about this, and this is clearly what you have. So then that person is like, okay, well, I have been diagnosed by someone. That's where I get kind of worked up.
Right. I actually, and we don't have time for it, but it does lead into the fact that I've had a lot of really strange experiences in my life, but I also am a hardcore skeptic. And part of that comes from the realization that eyewitness testimony, self-diagnosis, that's all on the spectrum of hoodoo. You know, without corroboration, I don't care if you saw the Virgin Mary in your toast, you probably just saw, you know, we need some outside perspective here. Like I said, man, I've been on Mike Davis's The Lovecraft Easy. We've talked about this. I love cryptozoology and UFOlogy and spirituality and all of it. But I also am a steely skeptic. And because you can't trust eyewitness testimony, and that includes yours.
For sure. For sure. Well, we will talk more about that next time if I would be fortunate enough to have one with you. Two quick questions, real quick questions. One, who is the gentleman behind you there?
Oh, that's old Bogey, Humphrey Bogart.
And okay.
That poster, it's like a full-length poster, belongs to my life partner, Jessica M. And she's had it for many years. And when we moved into this place, we're out here near the Catskills. We're renting a house in the country. I needed something. That door is an old, ugly door. And I said, oh, I got to put something up there. She goes, oh, you can have Bogey. And the first three or four months that Bogey was sitting there, every time I turned around, I'd jump out of my skin. I'm like, what are you? But now I'm like, oh, he's watching over me.
Yeah. Finally got used to the guest.
It took a while.
And then last question is, where can people find you? What do you have coming out? If, you know, if people
want to. Thank you. You can find me on Facebook or Twitter. Under my name. Also, you can go to LairdBaron, WordPress.com. I have a website. What's coming out? various stories, but the big news for now is I have a fifth collection, first ones almost would be in almost 10 years, is coming out late this year from Bad Hand Books, Doug Marino's press, and it's called Not a Speck of Light. And it's a fairly big book. It's over 100,000 words, and 16 stories. There'll be one or two originals in it, at least one big original in it. And but a lot of the stories have been, widely published. So there's a lot of people, I guarantee you that a lot of people will not have read a huge chunk of these stories just because of the nature of how disparate the publishing history is with them. So that's coming out in September, October.
Awesome. Yeah, I have in fact pre-ordered it, despite what my Twitter said. I don't know what happened the other day, but I could not find any evidence that it even existed. I tweeted that I couldn't find my pre-order or even you mentioning the book. Literally seconds later, I found everything I needed to find. And I left the tweet up out of shame. So,
but I'm really, I really love working with Doug, and I'm, I did a novella with him last year, a Coleridge novella. So I'm really excited about this, and he's a wonderful. He's publishing all kinds of great stuff. You should check it out.
Awesome, for sure. And that was Doug Marino, Bad Hand Books, correct?
Yep, they have multiple collections, novellas out from a variety of authors, especially hot upcoming authors. And I really think he's doing great work.
Awesome. All right. Well, Laird, thank you so much for talking to me today. I do appreciate it. I have a whole list of questions here I didn't get to talk to you about. So next time, man, have a good rest of your day.
Thank you much.
Take care.